when you are born, we want to know what where the constellations were in the sky at the moment of your birth, right? And the one that's just on the horizon is your rising sign. And so that's kind of going to color everything about you in this life. Kind of, it's like a tent that you see everything through, let's say.
This may not be the conversation you expected to hear about bugs, writing code, but a conversation with Josh Brown rarely goes as one might expect.
The sky is split into 12 sections, 12 houses, and each house refers to a different aspect of your life. Each house is essentially going to be assigned an astrological symbol, and then the planets and the sun and the moon are all going to be in different configurations within those.
Josh is the solution architect at Digital Scientists. He is the consummate philosopher, always looking beneath the surface, seeing what others rarely see.
If you're working on software that's not put together by someone who's very disciplined, who's like a true Virgo at heart, and who has everything organized and has all the systems set up, then it tends to just be kind of messy because people come in, they're given a task, they accomplish that task, and they're not really trying to leave it better than they found it.
Today, I accompany Josh on a meandering journey where we talk about bugs, how they happen and how to minimize them, code patterns and standards and good developer practices, and among many other things, maybe even the meaning of life itself.
Pro tip. Let's just leave it at that.
This is the Experience Lab, the official podcast of digital scientists from Atlanta, Georgia. We're an experience lab that explores and builds digital products. My name is Rob Hall, and I'm the Senior Director of Product at DS. Thanks for listening. Well, how's your day been?
Busy.
Yeah? What have you been up to?
The coronavirus quarantine.
Oh, yeah. I've been pretty busy with that, too.
I mean, it's just weird. You work from home and like other things just come up. It's just different. It's like it breaks your normal flow. And so
have you found yourself being more productive or less productive?
I've found myself having more stuff to do.
Really?
Yeah. Like drastically. I feel like I'm twice as busy as I was before quarantine.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I was talking about this with some folks yesterday and today. It does feel like on the whole, we're busier.
Yeah.
I know, like, I'm starting work around the same time as I normally do, but I don't feel this urge to stop as early as I normally do. So I'm not trying to beat traffic to get home or whatever. But I feel like my actual working hours are also busier.
They're busy, yeah. And there's just some weirdness where I'm not like a work from home person, so I don't have a bunch of experience with it.
Right.
But you need to step away from your computer some, you know?
Yes.
And so I feel like I have a little more guilt with that at home than I would at the office.
Yeah.
So something about that's not exactly honest yet. I feel like.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, like my relationship to it hasn't fleshed itself out, like my emotional response or whatever, right?
Uh huh. So, would you say you're just becoming aware of it as a thing?
No. I mean, I think I've been aware of it.
Okay.
But I don't always know how to deal with it. Just because you're aware of it doesn't mean you know what to do.
Right.
It just means you know it's there.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's like. I don't know. Yeah. It's like I had an interview to listen to for the CRM today. I had a bunch of them to listen to for the CRM today. And they'd sent me some like a bunch of videos to go over for the design sprint process. All that stuff takes time. I'm also putting a bunch of time working with Biff, you know?
Right.
And then it's like, well, I need to get my emissions done.
Are they still doing that?
Turns out I can answer that. And the answer is yes. Oh, at least for today. I'm not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm not sure if that's an essential service or not.
I mean, not to, it's good that we have like emissions tests. It's good that the cars don't pollute as bad as they used to.
Yeah.
But
I think it is important. We don't use leaded gas anymore.
Yeah, that's good. Although car engines love leaded gas. So far.
Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned that. Like 20 years ago, we were on a mission trip with my family in Africa. We were in the lower part of Zambia. And it may still be this way over there. I'm not sure. But at the time, all the vehicles that weren't running on diesel were running on leaded fuel.
Yeah.
And so if you were to ship an American car over there, you had to remove the catalytic converter.
Right, right, right.
From every car.
Yeah.
So that it could run on leaded gas. But I could understand why it was such a pollutant. I mean, just from the smell of leaded exhaust, it's awful.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't want lead around people for the most part. Destroys the nervous system.
Correct. You know? Or if you're Superman and you're X-ray vision.
You even get into a little conspiracy about that stuff if you want to dive down there.
I figure with you we could get into conspiracies about many things.
Probably. Software exists in two domains. It exists, you could say, like esoterically and exoterically. So there's the software that the developer sees, which is the esoteric side. It's the inner workings of it.
Okay.
And then there's the external aspect of the software and the UI and the interface and what the user is seeing.
The user experience.
Right. You know, bad software is a very generic thing to say. And you can cut across that in so many different ways. You could consider software bad if no one uses it.
Right.
You could consider it bad if it has a bad UI, if it has a bad architecture. If you open up, look under the hood, and it's full of exceptions to the rule or patches or kind of fixes for things, I would consider that to be bad software just because it's difficult to work with.
Right.
Difficult to work on. So on the esoteric developer side, like that's the part that is going to be a red flag for me. That's typically, I think, when you start talking about bugs, like I think that kind of plugs into the buggy nature of a system. It's like the more complicated it is, the more cognitive overhead there is, the more hidden dependencies you have between things, the more likely you are to end up buggy.
So you've used the leaky dam analogy before with me in talking about bugs.
Yeah.
I feel like in past projects, you and I have experienced that where you're chasing down all these bugs and then you realize another one's popped up over here because you're in this rush to try and fix things.
Yeah.
And it almost like creates this anxiety
on both
the product and experience side versus the developer side as well. We're here trying to manage expectations and keep everybody calm and extinguish the fire, whereas you're on the background going, okay, I need everybody to calm down.
Yeah, right.
Let's breathe for a second. We're going to get it fixed. But if I push this fix now, I don't know what it's going to do somewhere else.
Yeah, that can happen. So these systems that we work on get complicated, and we just have to accept the fact that like the systems get too complicated for one person to fully comprehend. Most systems are that way. It's like the economy is too complicated. Nobody understands it. Sorry, but nobody does. Nobody can accurately predict it all the time, or even a little bit of the time, apparently. So it's like that. The system gets too big. You have unrecognized relationships between things. Or you have coupling that you just you didn't account for or don't know exists. So you make a change and it has an effect that you didn't foresee. And that's kind of the idea behind the leaky dam. It's like the dam cracks, you put your finger to plug one hole, and then another one pops out somewhere else on the dam.
So how do you, when you're stuck experiencing that, how do you mitigate it? How do you mitigate the leaky dam? Do you have to just bust it open and drain the lake and hope for the best and then rebuild? Or do you call in backup and get more hands to plug the holes?
The industry is really has answers for this and has had answers for this for a while. So you want to have a set of automated tests. If you have to have some user testing to back that up, you can do that too. But that's really the best way. People don't often talk about this. This is like, you know, people talk about regression testing and integration testing and unit testing and whatever. But there's actually another class of tests that exists called characterization tests. And you can actually leverage other tests to be characterization tests. But the idea behind a characterization test isn't to check that the software is returning the correct data value, we'll say. Is to make sure that the software is returning the same data value that it was returning 5 minutes ago before you made your code change.
Oh, interesting.
Right. It's like the characterization is checking the integrity of the system to make sure that certain aspects haven't changed their output as a result of what's going on. So out of a lot of your testing, you actually get a little bit of characterization tests just by default. But to me, that's kind of one of the things that's going to help like shield you against, you know, pushing things up that are going to be buggy.
So it seems like if you have reached the point of the leaky dam scenario, you're in trouble. You kind of have to make your cross and pray and hope for the best, or be willing to blow it up and begin again. Whereas the approach that you're talking about with test-driven development seems more like a prevention measure.
It is.
That you want to build in and plan for ahead of time rather than after the fact.
It is. But like if you are in a situation where you didn't practice TDD on the way up, or maybe you inherited some software that doesn't have a bunch of tests written for it, and you need to push up some code, you have to push up a change, like you can write characterization tests. You know, at any point in time, that's where characterization tests come from, is when you work with legacy code. That's how you have to write tests around it, right? Because you don't always know, and you don't have the time or even the know-how to go back and like check all the math everywhere. So
right.
You can't go back and comprehend every line of code and something you've inherited. But you need to make sure that what you're doing isn't messing it up.
I've also heard you talk about cognitive load. What does that mean?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I interpret that, at least as a product manager, I interpret that as I've been switching contexts and having too many phone calls in a single day and I need a beer.
Right. Yeah. I tend to think of cognitive load as like how many things you're trying to keep in short-term memory at once. Like you can only keep like 7 things in your short-term memory at once. Like geniuses can keep like 11 things or something. I forget the numbers.
Yeah,
that's a different type of memory. If you have a million details you're trying to manage in this place, it's hard to think. It's hard to think in a little bit bigger picture. Yes, when you have too much to think about, it gets difficult to work with.
What can create that scenario? Is it, for example, too much abstraction?
For sure. Too much abstraction, I think, can do that. Doing like when you have a system that oftentimes you'll work with software and maybe the dev was just bored with old code, or maybe there were a bunch of devs who worked on it and they didn't want to follow the patterns of the previous coder. So they'll do the same thing in 6 different ways.
Right.
And now you have to keep track.
Or cleaning up their messes.
Yeah. Well,
like legacy code that's not used, but it's still there.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's a deficit in coders who want to clean things up.
Why is that?
I don't know. I guess, you know, in some respects, I don't really think that's a quality that I don't think it's really cultivated. It's not really fun. It's kind of like cleaning your room, you know. If you are someone who enjoys organizing things, then I could see maybe you'd enjoy that, but a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are kind of itching to just get the next thing. To get their next feature out the door or to implement whatever they're working on, you know, to go back
do
and clean things up.
Do my thing, get it done faster.
And I think sometimes it could be that they don't really see the value in it. I like convention because it reduces cognitive load.
And by convention, you're referring to creating a consistent set of standards that you're coding against.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, consistency. Okay. Things that you can rely on, you know.
Right.
It's nice to kind of be able to guess where something is. Like, oh, I need this, you know, to kind of guess where it's going to be. And it is there. That's a nice feeling.
Right. Absolutely.
Like early on in my career, I would get really bent out of shape. And when we pushed up a bug or something was wrong, like it would affect me emotionally. And I would feel like it was my fault. And I would feel like a bit panicked. And I just remember this one time where that was the case. The software was broken. And we were working on it. We hadn't fixed it. And we went to lunch. And the dev that I was working with was just completely unfettered, like just unbothered by the whole thing.
It did not affect him whatsoever that a bug had been pushed up.
No. And, you know, I talked to him about that, like why he just seemed so calm and placid about it, you know? And, he kind of just brought to my attention the fact that like, well, you're not going to solve it any better if you're emotionally worked up about it.
If you're like, frustrated about it, right?
Yeah. It's not going to make you concentrate harder or think clearer or act faster.
No.
And so that kind of opened up a whole world of possibility in thinking about that topic and the necessity to stay calm and relaxed in the face of things like that, especially when your managers are worked up. You need to come back to them with calm composure and just handle it.
So it's like a practice of acceptance.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we call it acceptance criteria.
Yeah, right.
but from my perspective as a product manager, there is a level of acceptance that we try to set expectations with. That,
yeah.
Hey, Joe, Mr. Customer, there are going to be bugs.
Yep.
We're going to do our very best through our process to avoid as many as we can, but they are going to happen. And here's how we'll handle it when they happen.
Absolutely. And it, that, you know, this whole concept of, like relaxed composure, I mean, this is like ancient wisdom. This is in all the martial arts and all the soft arts. You know, being tense is not what you want. You want your opponent to be tense, right? You want to be relaxed so that you can respond. That's really like a desirable state for a human in general all the time. Is composed, collected, relaxed.
Almost dispassionate in a way?
Perhaps. No comment. Don't know.
Is there a type of personality that seems better suited for development work than others?
So I don't really think so. I think that you have to have some like mental horsepower to be a developer, because it is kind of like this analytical, you know, you're thinking inside of a thought sometimes. Like you have to be able to kind of
inception your brain
a little bit, you know. It's definitely challenging. So if you don't already have like I said, like some mental horsepower, you're going to need a strong interest in programming. Like I think that could work in its place. I think just about anybody could learn it. It's just you have to have the personality type that's interested in it. That's really it.
Right.
But that's kind of with anything. Like if you're not interested in something and you try to do it as a career, like you're going to suffer a bit.
You're going to be miserable either way.
But there's a lot, you know, the field is really varied these days. There's a lot going on. So you can really have a lot of different personality types take on a lot of different roles.
Yeah, it seemed like in the old days you had a very clean line between back-end development and front-end development. Mm-hmm. And not a whole lot of muddied water in between.
Right.
Whereas now you had this huge shift towards JavaScript, and everything's in the front end, and the back end was kind of more minimal. But then now we're dealing with all these machine learning technologies and building learning models. So now backend development's really turned into this whole other thing involving data science.
Yep. Is that, and then like your real weird people go into DevOps.
Yeah. Right? Are you into DevOps?
I mean, I enjoyed it a little bit, and then I feel like the field just got to be a bit too much for me. Started moving too fast.
Yeah.
It's like some of that stuff needed to happen, but I also feel like everybody was a bit too quick to start implementing these things for projects and things that really didn't need them, for smaller scale stuff that doesn't really need an automated server farm that'll load balance itself and whatever. Like, you know, it's just a WordPress site for somebody's restaurant. Like, but then, you know, you got all the way down on the other end. You know, used to just be like front end developers or whatever doing CSS and HTML, and they all do JavaScript now. But you can push past that. You can push past that to designers and look at the prototypes that designers make, right? Compared to what that was 10 or 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They were just working in Photoshop files with 90 layers.
Yep.
Right? They're coming in from that other side and add more definition, which is really, really pretty good. And I think everything's starting to speed up. I think development in general is speeding up.
Yeah. What's nice to see too, from the design side of things is the ability to quickly articulate user interactions with just small animations and things that took a lot of time to visualize for a developer. Even when we were starting to do all these things through CSS a couple of years back, it was still very time consuming just to say, you know, just how to articulate motion.
It's like,
and the fastest way back then was animate it in After Effects and hope they can duplicate it.
I don't know if this is true, but it really feels like you could almost take any like above average designer today and send them back 10 years ago and they would be the best designer in the world. As far as like UI interaction goes.
Absolutely.
I feel like that whole area has come along so much. This gets a little weird, but there seems to be this like relationship between humans and information, and we needed to start ramping it up with the advent of the internet. That kind of kicked off even more. So early on, it was like, well, we need to increase the bandwidth, right? And once we kind of solved that
problem. I need to buffer my videos faster.
Yeah, right. Once we kind of solved that problem with broadband, at least we solved it well enough for the time being. It wasn't so much an issue of waiting on the dial-up connection anymore to get your information. It was like, the information's here. How do we speed up getting it to the human? And we had to switch sides and go to the UI, right? And smooth out the UI as much as possible so that people can easily see, they can easily visualize their data. Data visualization is a really big thing right now still, you know? And it just has sped up. And you can kind of see this across the board. Like even like the concept of a meme is really dense with information. You know, and it didn't exist before in the same way. So kind of like SMS and text was affecting the language. It was shortening things, like things are getting compressed.
Right. Exactly. Another
place where you see that. And so we've really worked on the UI. I consider like the first real big step in that direction was probably like the Apple's iPod Touch, right? So that was kind of the precursor to the smartphone UI.
You know, it's funny, like the smartphone space has undergone like this whole parallel development. Because you had the old Palm Trios and the Blackberries, where everything was very button driven and the screen was just there for feedback.
Right.
It wasn't your input device. And then the iPhone and the first iPod Touch turned all that upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Steve Jobs in his keynote introducing the iPhone was like castigating everyone for using pointers and right. and stylus, you know, because we have the best pointer and God gave us 5 of them or 10 of them.
Right.
It's your finger. Use right. your finger. Now there's an irony there that now, you know, Apple has the Apple Pencil and they just introduced trackpad pointer capability to the iPad and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. But yeah. Right.
Years later. But the point is, it was a new mode of interaction for a particular set of use cases that was far more efficient than what the Trio and the BlackBerry could do. But then the argument is still there. Well, that might be good for certain things on a small device, but you can't replicate the power of a keyboard and a mouse.
Right. But then but at the same time, it opens up other things because you have swipe, you have 2-finger swipe. So you end up with a few more gestures, and then you have the other added benefits of the phone with the accelerometer, the camera. So they started to kind of reach out in different ways and give you a little bit of a different view into that UI. And the smartphone now is, I mean, that's the most used computer in the world, right? People's smartphones.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about it, most of our smartphones are more powerful than the most powerful desktop computers were 10 years ago.
Yeah. Right.
And they're only getting faster.
Yeah. Because we're spoiled. Basically.
What would you say differentiates a good developer from a not so good one?
The developers that I don't like are ones that get projects into trouble, right? And that usually means that they are not, I like, if there's going to be a big decision or a difficult decision, I think those need to be communal. I don't think they need to happen in a vacuum. So in my opinion, a bad dev will make a big decision by his or herself and not communicate it. They will not seek help because they're afraid of looking stupid. And so when that happens, they'll continue to grind on a problem and make a mess out of it.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, in my career, those have been, and it's not like people are frozen in that state. I mean, everybody kind of needs to pay their dues and do this a few times. It's just a typically more of a junior level dev attribute is getting projects into trouble that way.
Right.
I think
if I just keep working, I will make it better.
Yeah. Yeah. And they just like, they're avoiding that light, you know, they don't want the light shined on them unless it's positive light. And they're just thinking too much about themselves and they're not thinking about the project itself. So the project is the goal, not you being a star, right?
Right.
Probably what I would say. I don't really like devs that are heroes either.
Step aside, I can take care of this.
Yeah, like, oh, I worked overtime for 7 months. It's like, oh, he said, or she is so dedicated. It's like, no, you're just messing up the expectations of what our job is for everybody else. Like,
I mean, I would make that argument for a product manager or a designer.
Right.
As well as a developer.
Right. But it goes back to, it's an ego motivation, right? It's a self.
Yeah, for sure.
And we all have egos and we are all self-serving to a degree, but
I guess,
but you know what I mean? Like, it can work against you.
Yeah. So something you've said, Brown, is developing a sense of non-urgency.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because we always work overtime, it seems, to cultivate the opposite in product managers,
mm-hmm.
Or anybody who's customer facing. You want to develop a sense of urgency so we can be on our feet and responsive and exceed expectations.
Yeah.
And now you're prescribing the opposite of that. Why is that?
As a dev, I think you want a sense of non-urgency, and that goes back to just being relaxed and composed. So if you're relaxed and composed, I mean, the best developer or the best development team is relaxed, composed. They make decisions, they make important decisions together, and the project moves in one direction. which is progress. Like that's what I want out of my teams. So if you have a sense of urgency, you're more likely to make mistakes or have to go back and redo things. Right. But I want everything to be clear, calm, moving forward in one direction. And I think ultimately the turtle wins the race. I don't really think there's a problem with speed. I think this is kind of another thing that's a little bit of a misnomer. If you want your project to happen fast, you don't need a sense of urgency. You don't need to crack the whip. You don't need overtime. You need very clear descriptions of what's required. You need good acceptance criteria, good user stories that show you actual detail. You don't want your developer picking the color on your button or whatever.
Let the designer handle that.
Yeah, it should be done, right? When the developers know what's expected of them, they work fast. They enjoy it. And so you'll have projects that don't have good definition. And to make up for not having good definition, the managers will attempt to crack the whip either in an overt way, which is less common, or in a passive-aggressive way, which is more common. That's just how it is. I mean, I don't think managers are special in that way. I think most people, at least in our culture, tend to be more passive aggressive than active aggressive. And that's okay. We should just try to not do that.
Right. I'd like to go back in time, talk about how you got into software development to begin with. And then fast forward, talk for a minute just about how, in your experience, developers can best be supported by product managers and designers. Because you're coming at this from a breadth of experience and a variety of experiences that a lot of developers, especially if they've only been doing it for a few years, have not experienced. But you've also come at it from the perspective of someone who has seen technology move a lot over the last decade.
Yeah.
Or longer.
Sure.
You are an old man now.
I'm old. Yeah. So I got in development. I was real good at math as a kid. And I was like exceptionally good at math for my high school, I guess. And so I thought that meant something. I thought, oh, well, I'll get like a math degree. I didn't know what that meant or where it would go, right? But I just assumed that like everybody hates math. If I do math, I'm sure that I'll get a degree and get out of college and they'll just hand me money, right? That's kind of my thing.
Yeah. It'll make you indispensable.
Yeah, right. I did a 4-year degree in applied math, and it was a complete waste of time, honestly. Like, I hated it. And I thought math was different from what it was, I guess. And when I finished the 4-year degree, I was so disillusioned with the whole field. I thought it was just a huge waste of time.
Why is that?
I think for me, it's a waste of time because a lot of it just doesn't relate back to the real world. Right?
It's a lot of theory.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you do have things that kind of relate back to the real world, like getting somebody to explain how it relates back to the real world, like they don't really understand it either, mm-hmm. you know? And I was kind of finding that with my professors. I'd ask them some questions about how some of these concepts related back. And, you know, they'd say, oh, well, you know, you can use this to describe electron orbitals for blah, blah, blah. And it just wasn't enough for me. You know, it seemed like some smoke and mirrors. I don't know. It didn't feel real. And, I liked that with computer science. I did like the math involved with computer science. I like discrete math. I think it's just more fun. And, I liked with computer science that when you work on something, you actually get feedback. You know, you're creating something.
Right. It talks back.
Yeah, it talks back. Like with math, it's like, I remember having a test. It was a take-home test. And there were like four problems and they were proofs. And you could go home and you could work on a proof for like 10 hours and not be any closer to the finish line at the end of 10 hours.
Yeah. You know, that's demoralizing.
Yeah. You know, so I demoted myself to computer scientist. And I went and I got a master's in computer science and did my thesis in AI, actually, in a taboo search. And I got to be honest, like, I thought that whole process was kind of a joke as well.
Really?
Not a big fan of academia. I think that there's just a lot of people kind of patting themselves on the back there. And I did not publish my thesis. I had people reach out that wanted me to fix it up for them to publish it, but I just wasn't proud of it, honestly. It just didn't really feel all that useful, really. So I finished grad school and you know, I needed a job. Instead of going out and getting a job, I started answering Craigslist ads for programming work. Which is kind of weird, but that's what I did. Right?
Yeah.
And I worked kind of just like weird contracts for people doing SMS back in the early days. This is like 2006, 5, 6.
Yeah.
And they were doing short codes. That was like, had just come out, and they were doing like these campaigns and like sports stadiums and stuff like that. So I was kind of working on that stuff. And then I got paired with a designer and we worked on a CMS together that we used for some kind of, I guess, pretty high level entertainment industry people back in the...
Did you meet any famous people?
No, I didn't ever meet famous people. But I logged in on their servers. That's something.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah. You know, whatever. There really kind of are some inbuilt stereotypes about devs, about developers not being social, and about developers kind of being like a bunch of Spocks. Mm-hmm. And it's not really the case, especially with the variety of the types of development now. You can really have people, especially a dev who's been doing front end work for 10 years, is going to have good input into UI decisions. You know,
yeah.
It just goes without saying. Like, there's just no way they can't. Like, I don't care if they have a degree in it. It doesn't mean anything to me. You know, they have actual hours on it. I think that that's part of it. But the, you know, the company that everybody works within has to really cultivate and find ways to get people communicating in order to kind of loosen up those restrictions, I think, right? People need to be able to communicate freely and, we'll say, in a friendly way.
Yes, and respectfully.
It's like if you do have people in your organization, in your agency, that have a hard time communicating with other people, there is a good chance that they're going to be on the dev side of things. I get that. But it's not the case that most devs are bad at communicating. I don't think that's the case.
I think it's just the weird DevOps guys that you keep talking about.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. Yeah.
No,
You really never know. Yeah.
No. In truth, though, you bring up an interesting dynamic that I've observed with some of our clients in the past, where you'll see the head of their technology group, so a CIO or a CTO, depending on how they distribute the role, can be very isolationist and protectionist over the things that they have built. And on one hand, you can relate to that. You can go, you have these complex systems that you have built and you have refined over many years. You're literally the train conductor, and you're doing a great job keeping the lights on. Without that infrastructure operating the way it does, everything would fall apart. But then on the other hand, I think that attitude or that disposition can fall into complacency and a resistance to continuing to move the product forward to answer new challenges that the market is demanding.
Yeah.
So a lack of innovation, a lack of cooperation and collaboration, I think, are the effect of that attitude and that disposition. And so I think it takes a unique individual to be able to balance both priorities.
Yeah.
Yes, we need the trains to continue running on time, but we also need to continue evolving the quality of the seats on the train.
Yeah. Well, it's not always the case that one person can do that. You know, I like to think in terms of, I think that people just have different qualities that they're good at. And I think everybody should kind of be aware of what their qualities are and what other people's qualities are, you know? And maybe you are the type of personality that's really good at building foundations and maintaining that structure, you know, maintaining stability. But you're not, you are not the type of person who's bringing in winds of change, you know? So maybe you need to seek out somebody who brings in winds of change, or you need to tap into somebody within your organization who's that person.
Right.
And lean on them to help with that. You know, so I think it's like, especially if you're going to be in charge of things, you're going to have like real responsibility. Like, you got to be self-aware. You got to know what your limitations are and what you're good at.
Good leaders always surround themselves with people that they perceive to be smarter than themselves.
Is that a Trump quote?
Absolutely not. Not even. Four steps to building a good developer and avoiding building bad software.
What?
Step number one.
Do I have
pairing?
Four? Oh.
Yeah, you gave me four.
I did?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Step number one, pairing.
Pairing. I don't know if these steps are in order. These are just, I'm more of a bullet list person than a
That's okay.
numbered list person. So yeah, pairing is invaluable. Pairing has a couple benefits. Like, one of the huge, huge benefits to pairing is that you can't get into a flow state while you're pairing. And I think that's really important. You don't want to be in a flow state while you're working. You want to be in flow while you practice coding, not while you're at your job. All right.
Hold on real quick.
Sure.
Just to clarify for our listeners, pairing means two developers working together at the same time.
Yeah. I've actually done it with three people at the same time. But yeah, sure. Two.
Okay.
Two can work.
Typically two. Typically I guess you could do it with three, but
you can. Yeah. Yep.
Now, what do you mean by flow state?
Flow state's like when you're in the zone. You're kind of in this like light meditative state where the world falls away and you're immersed in what you're doing. In that, you also can lose some of your higher order decision-making functionality, I find.
Because you are grinding away.
Yeah. Yeah, you can kind of get lost there. So it's like a good, okay. It's a fun state to get in. It's like, I think it's a healthy state to get in for a certain amount of time every day for a human. It probably helps just psychologically speaking to get into a flow state a little bit.
Right.
But if you want to write good software, I would argue against flow state. I would say you probably want to be a little slower, a little more precise, a little more conscious, right? So pairing forces you to do that, which is good. You also learn a ton of things while you're pairing.
So you're benefiting from the collective IQ of the pair.
Yeah. And, you know, no two coders code the same, right?
Right.
They just don't. Like, you can give everybody the same problem and you're just going to get that many different answers. So that's right. Cool to see. You learn a lot of things that way. And I'm a huge fan of pairing for the collaborative decision making you get out of that. So it really reinforces the advantage of, you know, when you have a big decision to make, of talking it out with somebody. Can really, really help out.
Second point on Brown's list of building a great developer, repeat yourself on important points.
Oh yeah, you should totally be a broken record. People are afraid to do that. I'm not sure why. Yeah, you should not be afraid to repeat yourself. Especially if you are a senior and you're responsible for someone who's a junior, don't think that you can tell them something once and they get it. It's just not how it works. So
continual reinforcement.
You need to brainwash them via repetition. It's just what it is. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No. I know it sounds weird, but
not at all. Number three, cultivate curiosity.
Yeah. I mean, this is ideally, you want people to be curious about their job. That's how they learn, is through curiosity. Like, any way that you can cultivate that curiosity is good.
That's, I love this one because it's also one of our core values as a company.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult to do because the field changes so much. It kind of grinds you down over time. Because as soon as you think you know something, it's kind of been pulled out from underneath you. And, you know, it's to kind of look at things with fresh eyes all the time is a challenge.
Last point, don't give them too big of a rope to hang themselves with.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to, like, you asked me what a bad developer was, when they're kind of isolating themselves and they're kind of running amok on a project, making a mess of things. So you don't really want to allow that to happen. It's going to happen some, and you should let it happen a little bit, because people need to learn through their own efforts, not just through you telling them. But yeah, I think you don't want to let it go in excess.
Thank you for listening to the Experience Lab from Digital Scientists. To learn more about our team and the great work we do, or even hire us, visit our website at digitalscientists.com.